Somebody hit a bongo?
What?
There was a really weird, like, muffled clap in there.
Well, I did bring out my DK bongos to get the show started.
Okay.
Because this week I'm talking about DK Barrel Blast.
Okay.
Oh my god.
For the Nintendo Wii.
Fair warning, I'm going to be absent for this episode.
Wait. Hold on a second. DK Barrel Blast didn't support the bongos. Because it was on Wii.
It was going to originally before they moved it to Wii.
Exactly.
We'll make it better!
Do you have the prototype version that you're going to try to sell for $50,000?
A game might have been kind of fun if it had been played with the bongos. Mm. It wouldn't have been great, but it would have been better than it was. Yeah. Anyway, let's get started. Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 303. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
As always.
If you build it, he will come. And Guillaume Veillette.
Bonjour.
And subbing in for John this week, who is away on some family medical leave, we have Michael TYP Cole.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll get there.
Yes. That's a great preview, Mike.
That was a very enthusiastic.
Yeah. That's because he just picked up his motorcycle and threw it at your face. So Wario is in the house. We are going to be talking about Wario Land 4 in the second half of the show for Retroactive. And Mike was the perfect substitute this week because he knows a lot about this series and this game. So he is well prepared. But first up, we've got new business. And Guillaume is going to start it off, although he and I share quite a bit of new business this week because some new things came out. Ain't that right?
Yeah, isn't it fantastic?
I know, it's like, whoa, new Nintendo stuff?
Man. Yeah. Well, I had decided that I would wait on getting the 3DS XL because I didn't like the colors.
How did that hold out for you?
Well, you know, I lasted about 3 days, and then I inexplicably came back home one day after work with a blue 3DS XL.
I would say it's pretty explicable. You went to a store and bought it. It didn't just materialize into your hands.
I don't know, I just blacked out, and all of a sudden, I was home with a 3DS. But, you know, whatever.
You are $200 poor for the experience.
My only regret is that I didn't get it sooner. It's pretty awesome. I mean, like, yeah. I was already a fan of the DSi XL. I liked the bigger screens, and it was more comfortable to hold, and it's exactly the same deal here. The screens are bigger, so you see better. You know, what else is there to say? The D-pad is actually fixed. Like, it's actually a D-pad that works.
It's good.
The buttons are a little clicky, but they feel better. Like, they feel more solid, more high quality than the buttons on the regular 3DS. I guess the only thing that I didn't expect is that the 3DS XL is not magical. It doesn't magically fix everything that was wrong about the 3DS or its games.
Nothing fixes Pet Zombie.
The DSi, when the picture is blown up, when it's bigger, you can see the pixels better, right? Like, you can see the graphics are noticeably more, what's the term, aliased?
Yeah, aliased.
It's less sharp, I think, is probably the better way of putting it.
It's less sharp. That's because your eyes do a natural aliasing effect when the gradient in the pixels is small enough.
Mm-hmm.
So your eyes sort of, it's actually less blurry. That's the problem. Your eyes have a natural blurring effect that they apply to make things look straight even when they're not.
So, but I didn't mind that in the DSi because I'm an old school gamer. I like pixels, so I don't mind if they're huge. I like that type of graphics.
When you're playing like 2D stuff, when you're looking at sprites, bigger pixels really just kind of make it look more 80s. Like, yeah. It's nostalgic in its own way.
But what I'm getting at is that the DSi, like, that was basically the only problem with making the picture bigger. With the 3DS, I still don't mind the aliasing, but there are other problems with the picture. The ghosting, for instance. It's not gone. It's just bigger. It's just more noticeable. Right. So if you're playing, you know, early 3DS games that have a lot of ghosting, you're just going to see it better. I did not really expect that. So it's a little bit of a surprise to me.
So does it have any bigger of like a sweet spot when you're like trying to keep your head kind of in that perfect zone to see the 3D?
I would agree with Zach and Neil, who both said that the sweet spot is actually perhaps a little bit smaller. Or at the very least, it's exactly the same. But it's not better. Like, it's not bigger.
Okay.
It's one of those really subjective things. I haven't done, like, a side-by-side comparison, but I haven't noticed it being different. But also, the games I've been playing on it since I got my XL have been almost all 2D games or stuff that just doesn't have much 3D effect.
And that's a your mileage may vary thing, too. Because it depends on how much your brain is willing to interpolate these images.
Mine's pretty good, because I've never had really a big problem with sweet spot. If I lose it, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I've never really had a problem with ghosting on this system, you know, so...
I have, but only on games that are truly not good at it. I mean, and there is a certain science to making the game not ghost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't mind a little bit of ghosting. To me, really, my challenges have been when I can't keep my head in the right spot. Like, playing Kid Icarus, I usually have to turn off that 3D, because I'm... Just to keep that thing comfortable in my hands, I gotta fiddle around too much with the... With the system to keep my head in a good spot.
What do you think in terms of the upgrade? Like, when you were playing it, you said obviously you only regret is you didn't get it sooner. What games have you played on it?
NSMB2, some Shinobi 3DS.
Shinobi would be a good example. So, because that game isn't like a super 3D megafest. It's, you know, it's Shinobi.
Yeah, but it would be one of those titles that has some ghosting to it.
And it's, I would assume it still does in this instance.
Yeah. Yeah, but despite that, like, the experience is definitely better. Like, I would never go back to the regular 3DS, that's for sure. You know, it's just a matter, like, I was just a little bit surprised by the effect of seeing not only, like, the picture better, but the blemishes as well.
So for you, it's mostly about the screen? I mean, because to me, I'd care more about the ergonomics than anything.
Yes.
Yeah, it's more comfortable. The the rounded edges really make a difference. It's a little bit... It's a little
did
bit,
they take the sharp, stabby point that was on the bottom of the 3DS off?
They did.
Yay!
I guess that one of the things that I wish were different is that they've got the SD card right where your right hand is. You can kind of feel where the door is and where the stylus is next to it.
It doesn't bother, but it's kind of like an irritant.
Yeah.
I haven't noticed that at all.
Well, to be fair, Guillaume can detect a pee when he sleeps on top of 100 mattresses, so it's fine.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty princess.
Yeah, everyone holds a system a little differently. I'm equally pleased with the screen and the ergonomics. And the thing is, I mean, it's an extra large 3DS. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And if you expect it to make everything look better or make the games more fun to play or something like that, you'll be disappointed. I mean, it's not a magic bean.
We're getting all kinds of fairy tales.
It is an extra large 3DS, which I think is helps in many ways. And but beyond that, it is redesigned enough that everything about it just kind of makes more sense. And you know, both of the American colors, the blue and the red, they have black bezels as well, but the bottom is black, so
right.
They match.
Yes,
that's the thing. Like it just looks. Aesthetically, I think it's a huge upgrade. I mean, mm-hmm. not that it matters that much. I mean, it's just the way the system looks, but the system just looks better. It all looks smoother. It looks more thoughtful in the way things are put together. And frankly, the proportions help a lot here because, yes, the screens are massively bigger than the original 3DS screens, but the system itself is proportionally not as much bigger as the original system. So effectively what that means is the screens now just use up more of the space of the system. So there's less plastic that you're looking at. You know, there's less wasted space.
And you said earlier that it didn't make the games more fun, but in a way it kind of does. I mean, have you tried going back to Marvel Pinball or Zen Pinball?
Not those yet. I went back and played. The first game I played on it was Nano Assault, and the aliasing effect that you talked about, Guillaume, was very evident in that game. Because that game, the art style of it, the presentation, I think leveraged the size of the 3DS pixels very carefully. And I realize now just how clever they were with it. It's like they designed everything and showed, like, you know, the camera was zoomed out far enough and the polygons are detailed just enough.
Yes.
That you, that all the lines seem straighter and all the models seem smoother than they really are. And now that you blow that stuff up, that effect is sort of lost. So the game still looks nice, and a lot of the effects that they use are still really impressive. But it doesn't have that kind of Mario Galaxy kind of sheen over it that it used to.
Yeah, you just have to get over it. With certain games, though, the extra... Yeah, the larger screens really does make a difference. I was going to say Zen Pinball. Like, you can actually... You don't have to squint anymore to see where your ball is. So that is a tremendous upgrade.
Well, I never had to squint, but if you have bad eyesight, yes, I could see that this would be a great benefit.
Oh, coming to blows.
If you're squinting at your 3DS screen, I think you're holding it too far away, or you really, really need the upgrade.
But when the ball is like in the far back of the table.
Oh, well, I changed the camera angle on that game so the camera follows the ball up and down.
Oh, I see.
To prevent that.
I see. I usually have it on the setting where you can see the whole table all at once, so nothing moves. But yeah, like the ball is extremely small in that case.
So, Guillaume, did you get a new video game to play on your 3DS XL?
As a matter of fact, when I blacked out, I not only bought a 3DS XL, but yeah, I got the new Super Mario Brothers 2. And I gotta say, like, with all the negativity surrounding the game and all the complaints that it's just more of the same, and the fact that they kind of rushed it, which I understand, I mean, like, they did rush the game, and it is a disappointment that there's not really any original music, or that the bosses are really an afterthought. I had my doubts about the level design, because I had played the game at E3, the demo, and I wasn't too impressed by it. I thought, like, wow, they're really going to town with the whole idea of the coin spinning or the block spinning, and that's kind of lame. But now that I'm playing it and I'm consistently having a hard time finding all the star coins in any given level, or I still haven't found the secret exit that leads to the cannon in World 1. I gotta say, like, the level design is more clever than I had thought. Just last week, I had been talking about another Super Mario Brothers Wii and how pleased I was that I couldn't find certain coins and how clever the design was. But I still that Nintendo is superior to that. Like, they just showed that they, you know, they do it better than anyone else. Going through any given level is really not that hard, but there's really, you know, like, you're going to be scratching your head a lot if you're trying to find everything. And that's usually how I play my platformers. So I'm in heaven.
Well, how much is, like, the secondary exits a part of this game? Because, I mean, that's something that could really be a huge draw for me, because there hasn't really been a Mario game that really focused heavily on alternate exits, kind of like Mario World.
It's still kind of the same deal as in the previous New Super Mario Brothers games. I mean, you're just going to have basically one or two levels per world where you have a secret exit.
Okay.
So I picked up this game as well, or I should say I downloaded it. I haven't had very much time to play it at all, but I like it so far. It seems fun. The raccoon tail works exactly as you remember from Mario 3, except you can just hold the button down. So, and I remember back in Mario 3, it was always like, you know, if I have this certain amount of space, if I run back and forth, will it do it? Or if there's an incline, will I get a little bit extra momentum if I run up the incline? Or if I run down the incline, will it, you know, will I be able to charge it up in less distance? And, you know, you're always trying to fly in places where you're not supposed to, or it's not obvious that you can.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of those ambiguities have carried over into this game, which is not a bad thing. It's just interesting to me that they've left that in.
Right. I've even gotten already my first street pass. And when I went and checked it out, it wasn't even his high score. It was someone else's high score that he had street passed.
Weird.
So they're viral.
They are. And basically, if you can do better than other people at these challenges, then they are going to be carrying your data, your high score around to other people for them to challenge. So I find that extremely cool. Like, this is way better than I thought it would be. Of course, like, you need to be in, you know, an environment where you can get enough street passes to be able to to enjoy this feature, but I think that for the people who can, like, this is actually pretty awesome. I actually have a coworker who has this game, but it doesn't look like she's activated Street Pass yet. So, you know, I'm going to have to get her on that, because I think that this kind of rivalry between someone that you actually know and that you actually Street Pass regularly would probably be the optimal way to enjoy the game. So right. If I can get that going on, that's going to be pretty cool.
Very nice.
So you haven't found that the coin collecting mechanic really is a distractor or detractor from kind of the level design? You think they mesh well together?
You don't really need to have it in the single player mode when you're doing the quote-unquote campaign. I mean, it doesn't really change anything. But when you try the coin rush, then all the one-ups become coin mushrooms. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if the single-player game is just training for a coin rush so that you can do better. You can find more of the hidden spots like that and do better at that mode. Yeah, I don't know. Like, it kind of makes it a little bit harder to recommend just based on the main campaign, which traditionally is what people buy Mario games for. If you're kind of fatigued by the Mario formula by now, I don't think this game is going to change your mind.
No, no way. No, it is really Mario.
But I was kind of, you know, suffering from Mario fatigue when I tried those homebrew levels, and I'm really enjoying this game. So I think it's just, you know, just different enough for me, but your mileage may vary, I suppose.
Cool. You want to talk really quickly about your other game?
Sure. I've been playing Retrograde on the PSN. Right now, it's an exclusive, although I think the developers said that after this version, they can focus on trying to bring it to more platforms. It's this interesting rhythm game that looks like a shooter, a side-scrolling shooter, except that, you know, like, you start off the game and you're shooting, like, this giant boss, and he explodes very quickly. It's very, very easy. The credits start rolling. And then, you know, you hear kind of a disc scratching noise. Everything rewinds. The credits roll back down. And basically from then on, you're playing the game backwards. And so you've got your own shots that are coming towards you and that you have to absorb. And then from behind you, you've got the enemy shots that you have to avoid that are going back to the enemy ships. So it's this very cool looking, very polished rhythm game. Like, you've got the buildings in the background that are kind of acting like an equalizer. You can see, like, their lights just going up and down with the beat of the music. You've got your character in your ship. He's actually visible. You can see, like, bobbing his head to the beat of the music. It you know, it's very endearing. And the game just looks cool in general. And then Yeah, it's a rhythm game. Like, you're pressing, you're absorbing your shots to the rhythm of the music.
I'm glad you described it that way, because I tried the demo for this and I was expecting it to be a weird twist on a shoot 'em up game, mm-hmm. and it's really not at all. It really is a straight up rhythm game, and it looks like a shooter, but it doesn't play like one at all. So if you go into it with that expectation, it's better.
Yeah, I guess the only shooter-esque element in there other than the visuals is when you're avoiding enemy shots, because that isn't really tied to the rhythm of the music. But yeah, other than that, like, don't expect a shooter, because that's not what you're getting. It's got some like, you can actually play this with a Guitar Hero controller, but I don't have any of, you know, I don't have any toy guitars here, so I haven't really been able to test that. And, like, you look at the leaderboards and all the top scores are really with the controller, a regular one. So it looks like it's the optimal way to play. I would recommend, like, if you decide to get this game, play the challenge mode first.
Does it get harder as you go? Because you're going from the last level to the first. So I was wondering, is this going to get easier as you go through the game?
Well, you know, like, it's an indie game, so there's a lot of geeky humor and there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek, you know, kind of stuff going on. And the description for the last level, quote-unquote, or the first, if you want to look at it that way, is the guy says, oh, well, you know, like, he had picked his battles. You know, he had decided to start with the toughest enemy, And, you know, his strategy paid off because every enemy was progressively easier afterwards.
So basically he backed through the fifth wall, just plowed right through the back of it. In reverse.
Yeah, I guess you can look at it that way. But yeah, like, try the challenge mode first. It starts off with really, like, on lower difficulties. You want to do them first, because if you start with the campaign first on a higher level, then you go back to the challenges, you're just going to get bored.
Guillaume, how would you describe the music in Retrograde?
Oh, God. It kind of grew on me, but I have to say that initially, I was not really impressed. You know, it's just your standard, it's just your standard electronic music. You know, as if, like, a TV producer said, okay, we need standard electronic music for this scene. You know, like, they're going to be watching, like, they're going to go to a rave, so let's have some, you know, electronic music in there. So, like, it's kind of maybe I'm being too harsh, but...
No, I think you're missing the point a little bit, because I think it's intentionally very retro video gamey sounding, but with a more modern dance beat. And as I was playing the demo, I kept thinking, this sounds kind of like Metroid music, but like sped up and kind of like locked into a stronger beat.
Actually, like I was thinking, like, okay, what are they going for here? Because it's not really like the electronic music that I've actually heard, you know, that I think that people actually listen to, but it's also not the, you know, video game music that I would enjoy.
So is it some bizarre halfway house?
Yeah, and it's not something really that I enjoyed. Anyway, like, as I said, though, when I started, I did, like, it did grow on me eventually. So right now I'm tapping my feet to the music, and I'm just getting more into it. And I'm doing better in the game, and I'm enjoying it so far. Yeah, like, if it sounds like something that interests you, definitely check the demo out.
Yeah, I think you should. So I'll go next with new business, and obviously I got a 3DS XL this week, and I got new Super Mario. I talked about those a little bit. I wanted to tell the story, the conclusion of my great lost 3DS experience, because I came out of it very, very, very happy. So, of course, I had the police report in hand. I've told that story. I had all the serial numbers that I got off of Club Nintendo, which was really nice, and I had the new serial number for my new system that I picked up on Sunday morning. So Sunday afternoon, it took a couple tries before I got through to Nintendo customer service, but I got through, talked to them. What happened is the person who picked up the phone was like, I don't know if we do that. You know, it's not really a standard process, but if you look it up, if you, you know, you tell them, hey, I already have a police report, then they kind of can get through the initial wall of the procedures, and they start getting really serious about, okay, we're going to like escalate it to, I don't know, customer, you know, some customer support admin will call you. So you have to send them an email with a police report and give them your phone number, and then they'll call you later on and with further instructions. So it's like, okay, so they're going to call me and give me some kind of RMA number so I can print out a shipping label and ship this thing off, which is what you would do if you were getting a repair for your Nintendo system. And that's what I expected. I expected I was going to take my brand new 3DS XL. I just took it out of the box, and I'm going to put it in an envelope and ship it off for a week. And they're going to go and put the licenses on there with some arcane method that they have. And then they're going to send it back to me. And it didn't go like that at all. In fact, it went much better. So, I sent the police report off, that afternoon, Sunday afternoon, after I got the system, and, didn't really expect to get a call that night. You know, because it's a weekend and there is a really busy, it was a launch day for a new system and a new game. But the next day while I was at work, I got a voicemail and I listened to it and it said, hey, this is James from, you know, Nintendo customer support. And wanted to let you know that we have that we got your report and we looked at it. And so we have put the Ambassador games into your download history. And we have emailed you a download code so you can get Four Swords, since that's not actually available. You can't browse for that on the eShop. It was a limited time thing. And we have put credit on your account for all the games that you lost.
Wow.
Which was $160-something, I think. So I was just astounded that this happened. You know, I was like, oh, wow, I don't have to ship off my system and I can just like get all this stuff tonight. I just go home and download it. This is fantastic, you know. So I was really, really, really happy about the way that they handled it. It was very quick, very polite. The person I talked to on the phone was very polite. So just very happy with the whole thing. And yeah, I mean, some people, you know, I was talking about it on Twitter, and some people were like, you should still be pissed off because you had to go through all this stuff. And it was like, yeah, I mean, yes, the entire process could be shorter and more elegant, and you really shouldn't have to bother your local police department to get this set up. You really shouldn't have to lose your system in order to move your licenses to another system. Now, I mean, obviously there is a way to do it with a system transfer if you have both right there, you know, but there are all kinds of other scenarios in which you might want to remove this stuff and put it on another system, and maybe they're not right next to each other when this happens, you know? So I think it should be a lot easier. I still think they should do it like Apple does with iTunes, you know, and Steam does it with their licenses for their mm-hmm. games. But look, with that said, yes, I had to go through a website to get a police report, which was not a big deal. And I did it, and I waited for the new system to come out, of course. But once I got the new system, in about 24 hours, I had, you know, all of my old games back. I mean, that's pretty fantastic. You know, all it took was a phone call.
Oh, actually, I'm kind of wondering, you know, I did the whole system transfer for my from my 3DS to 3DS XL, and you have a warning that you can only transfer your content 5 times. And you have to allow a week between each time, at least. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wonder, you know, like, is your... It wasn't really a transfer, so I guess that this whole thing didn't really count as right. one of those transfers for you, right?
Right, right. Yeah, there's no system transfer here. And I, by the way, I mean, that limit of 5 system transfers is ridiculous, and it will probably be taken away at some point. I mean, I think eventually they will lose that limit. It's sort of like... they have a limit now because it seems prudent, even though probably no one at Nintendo could tell you exactly what kind of fraud that prevents. You know, it's just like, well, we just don't want people doing this willy-nilly all the time, you know.
Right.
But eventually, and look, no one would need to do it at this point. No one would ever run up against that limit at this point in the life of the 3DS. But eventually that will happen. And when it does, they will probably just take away that limit because it's kind of like the limit on how many times you can play a demo. It's stupid. It's like some crazy person in Japan said, oh, we can't have people playing these demos over and over again. That's not good. But it really makes no sense. And eventually they will get over it. And I think they'll fix that. Yeah. Cool. So, yeah, overall, I'm very happy. I have a brand new 3DS and it's packed with games, which is great. But the other game I wanted to talk about this week, Dust, because James brought it up last week. He played the demo. This is the new Xbox Live Arcade game. It's a non-linear exploration-based RPG-lite action platformer 2D game thing.
What?
Yeah, exactly. It's like every genre, basically. I mean, it's all the complexities of like a Metroidvania game, but with lots of more mechanics on top of that even. And it looks basically like Muramasa, except it looks better than Muramasa. I think it looks a lot better.
I strongly disagree with that statement.
Really?
I think from an art style, Muramasa has way more creativity and way, way, way more intricacy.
Yeah, I mean, the characters in this are more, they look more like Don Bluth characters. So they're not super detailed, but they are animated very, very smoothly. And the worlds are really detailed. And what I love about the worlds is there's always something in the background or the foreground. Something's always moving. So it never looks like you're just looking at a painting. And that's how I felt a lot about Muramasa. There were certain screens in that game that would have the waves would be lapping up against the beach. I was like, I would just stare at it and be like, oh my God, this looks incredible. But a lot of the places that you go in Muramasa are very static looking. And that's not the case in Dust. Everything feels like it's kind of flowing. The whole game just has this beautiful sheen on it. And the big difference between this and Muramasa, and I'm comparing these a lot because you will think of this when you play Dust. I mean, it really will make you think of like a Vanillaware game. You know, Odin Sphere is another good example. And I think the big difference is in Muramasa, it felt like the backgrounds were being recycled over and over. And so you needed to stare at this map thing, even though there wasn't that much actual exploration in the game, but you needed to stare at the map just to figure out where the hell you were, because you'd go through 3 or 4 screens in a row that basically all look the same. And that is never a problem in Dust because there's so much more variety and diversity in the way that the environments are put together. And it just doesn't feel like they're recycling anything. And that it makes the game much more compelling to me. I mean, it's still, there's a lot of swordplay. There's a lot of really, really fast combo heavy action. But again, in Dust, it feels like it's more, it's better pace. Like you're not grinding on enemies for like 5 minutes before you can move on to the next area. It's much quicker. You know, you could say it's probably more shallow, but it just feels more satisfying. It feels like you're just mowing through these enemies and you're moving on to the next thing. Cause I think the combat is fun and it's done really well, but it's not the reason to play this game. The reason to play this game is to explore this world, to figure out, how do I get over there? What kind of ability do I need to use? There's some really great environmental puzzles. Like I did some stuff where there's these explosive fruits. This is like something right out of Zelda. There's these explosive fruits and you need to get it to a certain place to blow up a wall. But you can't pick it up and carry it. You have to like swing your sword in a, you have to spin your sword in a windmill to generate wind, and the wind will pull it off the tree and blow this fruit all over the place until you finally get it where you want it. But I went through this elaborate cave puzzle where I couldn't actually get close to the fruit. It's always on this other side of the wall. And so it's kind of like it's almost like playing with a magnet where you're trying to like pull this thing around corners and get it into wind gusts and like move it around all indirectly because you can't actually get close to it. And it was really great stuff. That was kind of the moment where I was like, oh shit, I love this game. I really do. I mean, I love it. I've played it for 3 or 4 hours and I'm not that far into it, but it just clicked with me very quickly. And at first I thought, this might be kind of like a shallow action game that just sort of stands on its really nice artwork and it's really pretty. But as I play it, I appreciate it more and more and I discover more things to love about it. The story is fairly serious. It deals with some pretty heady themes, and the writing, just the way the characters talk to each other, is actually really, really funny. So I'm a pretty huge fan of Dust already, and I'm trying to convince James to give it another shot at some point.
I don't have 3 hours to fall for this game. The demo did not leave a good taste in my mouth at all.
The demo is probably 15 minutes long, though.
I know, and you know, I played all the Summer of Arcade demos, and of all of the, well, except for the Kinect one. And of all the ones, that was the one I walked away with the worst taste with. So it's hard for me to say, well, I'll just go ahead and buy it anyway.
Sure. No, I can understand that. I mean, I think if you don't like the art style, you won't appreciate the game nearly as much as the people who do, because the game is just so art heavy. I mean, it is just this really, really glaring art style that's all over it. And if you don't appreciate the animation and the really smooth way that the characters talk to each other and the way that they flow on the screen when you're fighting, it's not that the game is bad if you don't like the artwork, but I think you're just not going to appreciate it nearly as much. James, why don't you tell us what you've been playing?
Yeah, so I've spent the last 2 weeks in the pursuit of a 3DS game called Rhythm Thief, which is the Sega-produced 3DS game that's not Mario and Sonic at the London Olympics, so i.e. the good one. It's been incredibly difficult to find, actually. What I've come to conclude is that not many copies of this game went on sale. For a while, when I was looking, Amazon didn't even have any copies, which is kind of troubling. You could buy them from the independent retailers, but they were charging way more than regular stores had as listed price.
Right.
I was seeing $39 was the only price I could find the game at, but all the brick and mortars were listing it at $29, so I wasn't going to shell out $10 to also have to pay shipping, so I was going to try to find it. And in the end, I managed to locate a GameStop that happened to have 2 copies. It was also the only GameStop in town that had more than one, and one of only 4 of like the 50 that had any. So I managed to acquire one of their 2 copies and then proceeded to take it home and have a few observations to make from it. I haven't had a chance to play a whole lot of it because I only got it yesterday and I worked late yesterday and then I worked kind of normal hours today. So I, first off, whoever played this game or whoever made this game and designed it played a lot of Layton games. I mean, all of them, multiple times. They played more Layton games than the team that made Dr. Lautrec. Thankfully, the main character of this is not a professor or a doctor of archaeology. He actually is more or less unemployed, as near as I can deduce.
He's a nurse practitioner of dance.
Nurse practitioner of archaeology. He is a dancer, although it's not entirely said explicitly he is a professional dancer up until this point, although he does have a dance troupe, so one must assume. But his primary means of earning income is the act of stealing artwork, which is probably not something you're going to put on your resume, but he does have an apartment absolutely stuffed to the brim with priceless treasures, so good on him. The game itself is really a collection of rhythm-based mini-games, most of them touchscreen control, but not all of them, strung together by a rather lavishly presented story. From a production standpoint, because this is really where the game is shining a lot so far, it's an incredibly gorgeous game. It's set to this incredibly colorful rendition of Paris, also kind of Dr. Lautrec-ish, but that's beside the point. There's the opening video for the game, which all the full motion videos in this game are gorgeous. They make tremendous use of 3D, some of the best I've seen on the system. I mean, they look, I mean, they're like moving dioramas. They look amazing. The opening one, he comes in, he's got like 17 chandeliers, like hundreds of paintings, like a statue, just in his tiny apartment. So I assume he's hoarding it for when the economy tanks and you trade artwork for food. I don't know. But it is such a lavishly drawn, animated, designed game. The background worlds are stunning. There is more than a passing resemblance to the Leighton art style, but everything looks smoother. You know, Leighton has kind of that faded out Tintin look.
Yeah.
Where this is a much richer color palette that the game is using. But the character faces kind of look the same. The world is kind of drawn the same. You poke the background for medals instead of Picards the same. That part all comes through. But the actual game itself, besides exploring Paris and getting into all sorts of issues, is a series of rhythm games that kind of punctuate the story. So in the demo, which is all I've played so far, the demo really is just the first package of story and levels with all the story bits stripped out. But for those who haven't played it, there's a fighting game where you're fighting the Knights of Napoleon, which is apparently, as the story has dictated so far, a zombified Napoleon in a suit of armor with a bunch of knights running around with big Mega Man style claws. And you fight them by kind of hitting the D-pad and the A button in rhythm with the indicators on screen, and also in rhythm with this kind of upbeat, jazzy, maybe a little bit hip-hop-ish sometimes music that goes with it.
Nice.
It's actually kind of infectious, even though you feel like, I'm really annoyed by this music, but it's fine. There's a scene where he's sneaking through the Louvre because he's off to loot it, apparently, again, and has felt the need to even notify them that he's coming, and it's kind of a Lupin the Third homage in that particular scene. Mm-hmm. The rhythm is you tap, there's four icons on the touchscreen that are the different poses he can strike, and you have to tap them in rhythm with the statues that are coming up on screen so he hides behind them. It's actually a really funny game, because there's a lot of times where he's hiding behind these completely absurdly shaped statues that make no sense, just so they kind of work in sync with the statue. But then there are points where he's just walking behind the security guard mocking him. It's really, truly enjoyable. And the game has that wonderful weird humor that made the Leighton games actually really enjoyable. I mean, at one point, you're cornered by your police adversary. He sicks the, quote, world-famous Parisian roller squad on you, which are a bunch of cops on rollerblades.
Oh, yeah. I remember running into those when I was in Paris. Yeah.
Yeah. And needless to say, if you're running up the surface of the Louvre and then jumping from building to building, rollerblades are not particularly advantageous for you. However, the rhythm game you're tapping out has you either jumping or sliding in rhythm with the music and also to avoid obstacles.
It works pretty well for Shadow the Hedgehog, so, you know.
Which is exactly why it doesn't work. But he also gets to drive his Cadillac and shoot guns at aliens, so let's go ahead and leave him out of this conversation altogether.
Fair enough.
I'm not too surprised by the quality of the presentation and the wackiness and, you know, the striking characters, because isn't this the same director who brought us Space Channel 5?
I believe it is. And you know, the music itself, it's not quite as popish as Space Channel 5, but there's a little bit there. You know, there is a little bit of pop energy to it. All the music I've heard so far is really, really high energy. And it really goes well with the vibe, because this isn't like, you know, spy and caper crime thriller here. This is one character. This is, like I said, this is
a fun adventure.
This whole game feels like a giant Lupin the Third homage.
Wow.
I mean, it really does. You know, he's charming. He will more than willing reveal that he is the Phantom R to eligible women around Paris as he's running from the police. Like, he has no qualms about just totally laying the cards out there and telling them who he is. Just because, you know, he can. Like I said, he literally told the police, "Oh, I'm going to steal this specific item from the Louvre on this day. Oh, and I'm going to bring my dog along with me because screw you. What are you going to do about it?" I mean, the whole game is just ridiculous and amazing, and I absolutely adore it.
One of the reasons why I didn't pick this game up is because I actually got Space Channel 5 Part 2 off PSN. And I wanted to complete it first, but I find it extremely hard. And part of the challenge...
It is tricky.
Part of the challenge is sometimes I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. Like, I'm currently stuck in this electric guitar battle, and it's extremely difficult to know exactly which buttons I'm supposed to press.
Has Michael Jackson shown up yet?
Not yet.
Oh, he's in there. It's the highlight of all things Sega has ever made is the appearance of Michael Jackson in Space Channel 5 Part 2.
But yeah, I'll be interested to know, like, once you play more, if the difficulty spikes up considerably, because
well, there's never any real ambiguity about what you're supposed to do. The game literally shows you what button or icon you should be tapping/pushing, and then there's a ring that basically closes on it, Elite Beat Agent style. Right. There is apparently a checkbox that I've kept checked that says something like tutorial, but I'm not sure if unchecking that makes those go away or if it just doesn't give you as much prompting before you start the level.
Right.
Either way, the first few are really easy. I'm in somewhere in the middle of chapter two. I think there's like five chapters at this point.
So James, given that there's clearly a weak supply and more demand for this game, and probably is a very large 3DS card, which probably made it more expensive for Sega. Do you think this is a really good candidate for digital distribution?
What we know about what from third parties about what Nintendo said for a digital distribution model, I mean, we've heard things like you would be crazy not to do it. I would think it is a good candidate. I mean, we know it's not more than a handful of gigs, regardless of how big it is. So, you know, maybe it would be a bit big on to do, but I can't see why you wouldn't at least consider it. I mean, it really would alleviate all the issues with this game, because it would be the kind of game that I might
like
actually...
finding it?
Yeah, but it would be the kind of game that I might want to keep around on the 3DS, too, because you can pick up levels and just score attack them if you want, and try to get higher scores on it. So, I mean, it would be fun to have around in that regard. I'm planning
I could see
on...
Sega especially doing it, like, maybe... Maybe like towards the holiday season or even right after, while a lot of people have new systems and they're looking for stuff to buy, you know, doing it in January or something, because then by that time there's enough time passed that you can put it on the eShop for a reduced price, let's say like 20 bucks.
Yep.
And they will sell it to so many people who would never have bought it and could never even find it, even if you could. I mean, that's the thing. Like, once the game becomes really scarce, they're definitely not going to put up the money to, like, reprint it, you know, because it didn't sell that great in the first place. It came out, like, the same week as Theater Rhythm, which is just moronic, especially after all the needless delays in America.
I know.
You know?
It's like they specifically delayed it for it to do as poorly as possible.
Yeah. So, to me, this is a game where they could come back and probably make a lot of revenue on it several months later, you know, after a pretty much a failed retail launch, I think. I mean, we haven't seen numbers. I don't think we'll ever see numbers because this is not going to crack the top 30. Okay?
No, and I just don't think there were enough copies made for it to be a successful launch, at least not on my experience. I mean,
and Sega's marketing team is... I don't even know if they have one left.
No, they do. They're in Europe.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's no surprise that Sega has trouble selling games in America.
Yeah. It's a weird... Sega is in a very bad situation right now, and this is a really cool game that if it came out earlier in the 3DS's life cycle, probably would have been a big hit, especially before, like, 3D Land came out.
Mm-hmm.
But it came out too late, and then they delayed it a bunch more times, and now it's in a really crappy position because it's a cool game. I don't know how well the rhythmness holds out. If you remember the review that we cited from the site earlier about 3 weeks ago, the comment was that the presentation was really great, but it wasn't a great rhythm game. At the moment, I wouldn't agree with that assessment, but I'm not that far into the game, so I might change my tune at some point. But, you know, this is the kind of game, though, you could probably put on the eShop and sell a lot of copies. And I think it wouldn't be that difficult either. I think you could just, you know, when you could drop the game to $10 at this point because there's no cost involved besides Nintendo taking their cut.
I think they could sell this for $20, though. I mean, maybe. People know that this was a retail release. It was recent. It has great production values. It has cool music. It's from Sega. I think you could sell this for $20, and it's still a great deal.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, $29 for a 3DS game isn't bad in and of itself. I mean,
right.
So it's, I mean, even right now, it's a pretty good deal unless you're getting fleeced online. But
effectively, you can't buy it for $30. I think it sounds like you're kind of a fluke.
Yeah, well, I mean, I you can get it, but you have to be persistent. I mean, that's really what it came down to. I was, you know, thankfully, sites like GameStop have very good is this in your store trackers. And, you know, that was how I ended up catching it. And I, you know, I called and said, "Hey, will you hold this?" And they did. And I went there and I picked it up. But I mean, really, the only way to get this game is either get lucky or really try to pursue it.
Well, I'm glad you got lucky, James, and I'm even more glad that you liked the game. I would like to check it out at some point myself. I know Greg liked it a lot too. So I mean, I've heard lots of good things about it at this point.
And there is a demo right now on the eShop you can go play. It's a pretty good representation. It just doesn't have the presentation bits, and really that's where the game is really shining.
Hmm. Cool. Yeah. All right, so he's been waiting for his turn, and it's time now for us to hear from TYP.
I think I'm a bit too exhausted to do now playing now. you guys have pooped me out after an hour of discussions, but no, seriously though, I'd first like to talk about a game that James touched on last week, and I believe I talked about on this podcast a long time ago to some extent, and that's Mole Mania.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
So as some listeners may recall, I purchased a Japanese copy of Mole Mania shortly before I left Japan, but it was a bum copy, which kept crashing on me or locking up on me, and the save didn't work on it. So I didn't get too far in that game.
I don't see the problem.
Or more accurately, I got a little ways into it, and then it locked up, and then there was no save, so I said, screw this. you know, I wanted to give another chance because I knew it was a fun game, but I hadn't really gotten too far into it. So I downloaded it, and it's kind of funny, but as I told Johnny a couple of days ago, I think it's kind of the missing link between Lolo and Portal 2, which...
All right, yes.
What?
Okay. Whoa. Yes. Let me explain this.
I fully support this theory.
Yeah, so... So
that's a big link to be missing.
As James mentioned, it's basically using the Link's Awakening engine more or less, and but a lot of the games involving, you know, pushing blocks and trying to avoid enemies, and you know, just sort of trying to figure out the lay of the land and then executing. And that's
very Lolo.
That's very Lolo-like. But what this game also has is this digging mechanic, and I don't think James really explained the digging mechanic all that well.
No, I don't think so.
So I
wasn't very far in the game at the time either.
So one thing to keep in mind is that when you dig, if there is not already a hole where you're digging down, you create a hole, and that actually is kind of an obstacle because you can't push things over that hole in a lot of cases. So you have to be really judicious with where you dig, and often you wind up kind of digging just to see down below, because there's the above ground and below ground, so it's kind of like two different, I don't want to say two different worlds, but they're interconnected.
Two different play fields.
So basically you create one hole, and you might have to create a hole, you know, come back up another area, and so you have this kind of... inelegant portal from one place to another in this level, and I felt like a lot of the, since it's a very block, you know, block puzzle heavy game, it really does feel a lot like Portal in some ways, and each world seems to introduce its own unique mechanic. You know, there's a world that introduces blocks you can only push, you can't pull or throw. There are areas where there's one where there's a barrel. And if you push the barrel into a hole, it creates a, you know, it fills in the hole so that you can push something on top of it. But then if you dig under, that barrel is blocking your way. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the environments. And like James said, the bosses are actually quite inventive. So I don't know. I think it's a pretty cool game, and it's cheap. It's like what, $3?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it was $2.99.
So this is like a no brainer. If you like Zelda games, if you like Portal, if you like Lolo, any of those games, this is somewhere in between those games, and it has its own kind of weird humor in it. Like you get your advice from the grandpa mole, but if you keep talking to the grandpa mole, he gets like angry with you. And if you continue to talk with him, he kills you.
What? I didn't even know
if
that.
If you keep talking
my...
to him, you get a game over screen.
Nice.
And it doesn't do anything because you respawn right at that room. Right. The last room you cleared, you respawn there. But I don't know. It's a very interesting game. Definitely worth a few bucks. I doubt many people have played it. So it really is kind of a lost treasure and an excellent example of why Virtual Console is so awesome.
I would say the thing about the underworld overworld interplay is that while you could dig these holes that end up being real hazards, you kind of get a little bit of a do over because you can flip the ball that you have to roll into the barriers
right
over the hole if you're in the hole.
Right.
But that's only one do over. If you screw it up and get two holes in a row, well, guess what? You can't stop that second ball.
Right. And sometimes if you throw, it'll just roll into another hole. So, I mean.
And you're just like, what am I supposed to do now? And there's a lot of restarting and starting over again that can get really frustrating sometimes. Sometimes the bosses have to be killed in a very specific way that the game will tell you how to do it, but it'll only tell you by this like sign buried in one of the levels that you have to get to, and it may not even be immediately accessible from the level you're in. You may have to get to it from another room, like dig underground in one room and then go into the next room.
So do you have to resolve all the puzzles that you've already solved once?
No.
Like
no.
When you go from room to room?
No.
Once you clear a room, all the enemies are gone forever and the puzzle's solved.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's like clearing a room. And I think there is a way to go back and replay that or something, but...
Yeah, I think you put like a challenge mode or something.
Okay, the other game I wanted to talk about was Rayman Origins. I don't remember if anyone talked about this game on this podcast or not, but I finally had a chance.
Well, I wanted to when I was a guest, initially, but then I was told, no, we'll talk about it eventually. And then no one ever did.
That'll teach you to listen to us, won't it?
Yeah, so I purchased Rayman Origins a couple of weeks ago, basically because it was used on Radio Trivia and it sounded so intriguing. And reminded me, I really liked the sequel at E3, so maybe I should pick up that original that's like $20 now.
And it's dirt cheap now.
Yeah, I got it for $20 new on PlayStation 3. I think it's the same price across the board. But it's 1080p. It's funny you mentioned like Muramasa and how sometimes it looked kind of static, because I'm torn on the art style in this game. I think it's really detailed, and there are things that are animated in this game, but at times it does feel kind of static. And I guess that's just a necessary evil.
A little pre-rendered, right? Like it feels like you're, it's like in those old cartoons where they have all these keyframes, and so it's like you can tell what's going to be interactive because it looks a little brighter than everything that's in the background, even though it's all supposed to be flat on a 2D surface.
Yeah, that's fair.
It's like it feels like the world isn't. It's really beautiful, but it's not. Most of it's not interactive.
It doesn't feel. It feels kind of inorganic because of it.
Right.
Right. It's not tangible, like because your character doesn't really touch things. He just sort of floats on top of things a little bit.
And like the controls are kind of loose, so that adds to that impression.
They are, and that was one thing I was going to bring up, is that I'm really enjoying it. It definitely has like a Donkey Kong Country flavor to it. It's probably because it's a European platformer, and so it probably pulls from some of the same things.
Well, Donkey Kong Country Returns more than the original trilogy, I would say.
I don't know if I'd make a distinction. One thing that... I was a little disappointed in is that they do have like bonus rooms that are very much in this vein of Donkey Kong Country, but they're not that well hidden, almost on purpose. It's like they have the help me.
In the demo that's out on 3DS for the sequel, you can see it, like literally there's a person pointing to the room in the background going here. Yeah. It's like, well, I wonder where that hidden room is.
Right. So it's kind of weird because they got these hidden areas, but it's more like the fact that they're hidden is kind of superficial. It's really more about these are just fun little areas to play. But
well, they do get trickier to find eventually.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm pretty far in now. I'd say I'm like more than halfway through, or there's a point in which it starts to kind of recycle assets. You're basically revisiting second versions of the same worlds, more or less. I don't know if I'm describing that well, but basically you play like the four or five kingdoms, and then they say, oh, go back, and like they unlock basically more areas in that same theme that you play. Right. And so it isn't that it feels recycled, but it feels like it kind of, to some extent, rehashes, at least visually. But it's not entirely true. I mean, they do have new game mechanics in those newer sections, and the boss battles seem to take over. Like, all of a sudden, you got these boss battles that are pretty epic, and there weren't really boss battles in the first half of the game. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff in there. The shooting parts are actually pretty well done, I thought, with the mosquito.
Yeah, but they're still kind of a distraction to the main action, though. I mean, like, they're well done, but they're not quite up there, I would say, with the platforming.
I don't know. I'm having fun with it. I mean, I think there's some clever things they do in a couple of levels with that, with ricocheting off of, bullets ricocheting off of corners and whatever. I don't know. I'm having fun with that. I also thought that there was some weird influences from New Super Mario Brothers with the Mini Mario. Because you can shrink down after a way. There's a power-up you earn where you you become a small Rayman, and it kind of affects how you control. You're kind of floatier, and you can actually kind of go upwards with your attack move. So
there are lots of references to Mario. I mean, even what you were just talking about, the side-scrolling shooters, is probably a reference to Super Mario Land.
Yeah, probably is. Yeah, you're right.
So I think it's all over the game, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, but I do feel like there are some pitfalls there. As Guillaume mentioned, the controls are a little floaty. And again, that's kind of like Donkey Kong Country. But that causes some problems with the ones where you're chasing the treasure chest.
I mean, like, those levels are challenging, but they're kind of the temple run in DKCR.
Yeah.
Those were challenging as well. You had to be extremely precise. But yeah, like, I think that Rayman has even looser controls than Donkey Kong did, and that leads to some problems. Like, you have to be, sometimes you almost have to guess what the game wants you to do, like the exact moment that wants you to jump, otherwise you're not going to make it.
Yeah, I found that, like, a lot of times I'm like, wait, what did I do differently this time to cause me to not quite make it to the other end of, you know, the jump or whatever? And I'm sure it was just timing, but I guess I just don't have a great feel for the timing on those sections. So, I mean, they're fun, they're challenging, but the fact that you restart from the beginning, the music restarts, it gets grating over time. And after recently playing, you know, VVV, where it's a very, you know, there's a lot of that kind of very difficult platforming that requires very, you know, good timing, but you aren't really punished that much because you respawn so close to where you die that, and the music just keeps going. It isn't like it's kind of saying, no, bad, no, bad, no. It just, I don't know. I mean, it just has a different vibe to it. And I think I appreciate that aspect of VVV a lot more after playing this game. No, but the game is still really good. And I'm looking forward to the sequel on Wii U. And hopefully the tablet will introduce some interesting things there too.
I played the Wii version of this game because I could find it for very cheap back when it came out. So I decided, oh, you know, why not? And also, I have more controllers for the Wii than for the PS3, so I thought this would be a good multiplayer game. It kind of turns out that it's not that fun multiplayer.
No, it isn't.
It's just too chaotic, and people weren't enjoying themselves.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt about New Super Mario Bros. Wii. I felt like it was just too much crap going on at one time, that it just became kind of a pain. Like, with two players, it was manageable, but with four, I just got frustrated.
Absolutely.
Well, the thing is, it depends on your intentions, because if your intention is to get through the level and for everyone to do well, then that is not going to happen.
So somebody's going to suck at the game and steal all your lives.
Well,
actually, I would say the better everyone is, the less likely it is that you will actually make it to the end of the level. When we played Rayman Origins multiplayer at E3 last year, We played four player.
Oh, it was a wreck.
I don't think any of us actually survived to the end of the level, and I had a great time with it. But it becomes a fighting game. It becomes Smash Brothers at some point. Mario's the same way. It's like, you know, if your intention is to make progress through the game, then playing multiplayer is really frustrating. If your intention is to laugh and have a good time, I think it serves its purpose wonderfully.
Not only people were just started slapping each other and, you know, having a good time, but then afterwards, it wasn't really fun to keep going. And I don't know why. Like, we ended up switching to Kirby Returns to Dreamland, and we had more fun going through levels that way. Probably, like, the level design in Kirby being more forgiving probably had a lot to do with this.
I think it's a very similar phenomenon to, like, a lot of dungeon crawlers, where a lot of it's just the fact that you're playing with your buddies. And the level design, as long as it's passable, maybe is secondary concern to being able, you know, having fun coordinating with your friends.
Yeah, I can see that.
There's just no way to design a level that is equally as fun for one player as it is for when you have this much interaction among the people. You just can't do it.
And looking at the demos or the demo videos from its sequel, at least the ones I showed at E3, it feels like they did a good job developing levels that look fun with at least two players.
Yeah.
The interaction between the tablet controller and the player who's not using one, it does make me wonder how the game will play if you only have one player. And they might have gone the opposite direction on this one. I don't know yet.
One final note that I want to make about the Wii version. Of course, it's to be expected that the Wii version is not going to look as good as the PlayStation 3 version, you know, because of the difference in resolution. But I also found that the Wii version was not as good looking as other 2D Wii games.
Mm.
It's very strange, but I think it was really made for the level of detail, like a high definition level of detail. And when you shrink that back down to standard resolution, you lose more than the details. Like the picture didn't seem as appealing anymore, and I'm not sure exactly, you know, if I can explain why. But yeah, like I found that Kirby Returns to Dreamland looked better. The colors were more bright.
Yeah. Okay, everybody, that's going to wrap up new business. It was a big one, so I hope you're going to stick with us for Retroactive on the other side of the break when we talk about Wario Land 4 with the man himself.
Oh yeah,
with Wario.
You bet.
Well, that's going to be a short Retroactive.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we've got a review for Ace Mathetician? Mathetician?
No, Mathetician.
Ace Mathetician for DSiWare by a very generous Patrick Barnett. He says it's a math puzzle game involving apes? No, it's not TK Junior Math, it's Ace. Eighth Mathetician.
Just go with it.
And its unique take on formula-based puzzle solving adds up to a good time and an unpronounceable title.
We also have impressions this week of Dragon Quest X Online, Mezumeshi Itsutsu no Shizoku, from Matt Walker. It's been in development for years. It requires you strap a dedicated hard drive to your Wii, but it turns out it's a nice, quote, beginner's MMO, with the battle style that is, quote, identical to another forced foray into the MMO space, Final Fantasy XI.
We have a feature, The State of Your Wii, by the entire staff, or almost. We look at what has become of the staff's collective Wiis. Come see pictures of dusty consoles and the Voltron-style hybrid station called the 3-Earth. Andrew Brown has used his Wii to form the head of.
It's truly a bizarre-looking piece of kit.
Jokes about dusty Wiis are so old.
I had no intention of doing that. It's just what we had.
Finally, we have Inside the Bubble, Nintendo World Report's video wrap-up of the week's going on, produced by Ariel Ruff. It's really a great way to catch up on news and stuff. Warning, this week has a horrifying video of freaky forms.
All videos of freaky forms are horrifying.
This has freaky forms combat, which is actually more horrifying than anything thus seen by the franchise.
These videos inside the bubble are really good. They're like weekly wrap-ups of news, so it's a great way to sort of catch up if you feel like you're kind of getting behind on the news. And they're very slickly made, very, very terse. Good stuff.
5 minutes.
Yep. So be sure to check that out and all the great original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. We are finally ready to talk about Wario Land 4, the retroactive that will never die. We don't want it to die. We wanted to get around to it. But
I actually want it to die.
With the summer festivities and the 300th episode and all that crap, it just kept getting pushed off. So I'm glad that we're finally doing it now. And, you know, it's a really interesting game. And of course, it was voted on in the second chance poll, so it was a democratically chosen game for retroactive, but I think it really fits in with some of the best games that we've done for retroactive, which is that I don't think this is anyone's favorite game, except maybe Jeremy Parrish. And I don't think most people hate it either. I think it's, even though it's the fourth game in a series, it's actually a lot different than the Wario Lands that come before it and the ones that came after it. And it, so it is this kind of weird island unto itself. And it's just a strange game with a lot of, a fairly complicated design that there's a lot to kind of pull apart and chew on here. So I reviewed this back on Planet GameCube a long time ago when it first came out. So my thoughts are readily available in pretty great detail. And after playing the game for 5 or 6 hours this week to try to catch up and refresh myself, I don't think my opinions have changed that much, although they're in a slightly different context now that I've played Shake It. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, but I'm really curious. I don't know as much about what you guys all think of it. So let's start with you, TYP, because you and I have briefly discussed this over the years back and forth, but I'm not sure that I have a really great idea of what you think about Wario Land 4 in general.
Yeah, so I also reviewed this when it came out. So,
Oh, snap.
Yeah.
I need to go read that.
I was quite positive on the game when it first came out. I definitely was impressed with the graphics. To be honest, my review was a little rambling, so I didn't read it all. It was probably my first review.
Self-criticism.
Yeah. But, no, seriously, the aesthetics, I mean, I've always really liked the music, and I thought the visuals were pretty good in the game as well. Most of the levels really are unique. Each level kind of has its own thing, or they're, for the most part, each level has a unique catch or hook to it. And it was much snappier than two or three, Wario Land 2 or Wario Land 3, in terms of its pacing. I think over the years I've become less fond of it, in part because I feel like the transformations are kind of an afterthought in this game compared with a lot of the other Wario Land games. And I think we'll talk a little more about that. But so I feel like Wario Land 4 is fun, but perhaps not as quirky or as memorable over the long term as some of the other Wario Land games.
It's certainly not as funny. I mean, I would say in terms of sheer laughs, I didn't really get that many out of this game.
Well, James, are you comparing it to other Wario Land games or to WarioWare?
Well, no. I mean, to an extent, yes. But I mean, I thought the absurdity of this game is kind of high, but I never really felt like, hey, this is really kind of amusing. Not like really solid laughs, just kind of amusement laughs.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I don't associate Wario Land with funny humor or laughs. And in fact, that's one thing I don't like about this game is that it started to introduce some of this weird kind of like disgusting humor, or it was the start of what became WarioWare.
No, and I get that, but what I was trying to say is that it seems to be trying to do it, and I just didn't get it, if that makes sense. Like, it feels like it should be more memorable than it is.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I felt like later Wario games did get more silly. Even Wario Land Shake It is pretty silly.
Yeah, but Shake It has the benefit of much more sophisticated animation, so they can show more of the character. But
certainly, for them, those later games, you know, WarioWare is incredibly silly, but even Shake It is silly. This game just felt like it was weird more than silly, so in a way, it didn't seem incredibly memorable.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds kind of conflicted. I'm trying to make sense of what I'm saying. It's just hard to get out.
Was this your first time playing it, James?
It's my first time playing it in a long time, let's put it that way.
Okay.
And I don't remember very much of the first time I played it.
And Guillaume, what about you? You're a huge 2D platformer fan, so this is really nice to have this as your... Is this your first retroactive or second?
It's the second one I did Moto Heroes.
Oh, that's right.
Before Mario he was Heroes, officially so. On.
Also kind of a 2D platformer, but yeah. Wario Land 4 is definitely much more so.
Well, as I've mentioned, I think, before in the podcast, Wario Land, the first one, was kind of the swan song of my Game Boy back in the day. One of the last few games that I played on that system. And so I skipped 2 and 3, and I got my GBA kind of late. And I guess I skipped this game, and I'm not sure why. I think that the reviews were so-so in general. And
it was
I was
a pretty
less,
early GBA game.
Yeah, and I was less willing to take risks on, you know, 2D platformers at the time. I don't know why. So I skipped that game originally, and this is the first time that I played it. It's kind of strange, but I, you know, like you guys mentioned, the graphics, how pretty they are, and I just remember the style and the graphics of the game just kind of, repelling me. Like, I was like, wow, this is not the Wario Land that I know. The game, like, does have a certain amount of nice details. But it's kind of strange because this is also after having played Shake It, which was just gorgeous. And mm-hmm. so, like, this looks like it's in an awkward phase where it's not detailed enough to be as beautiful as Shake It. And it's not simple enough to be as, you know, nice looking as the Game Boy games, in my opinion.
I know what you're saying. It's kind of at a muddy halfway house. I hate using that again. It's sort of muddy. I mean, I know where you're coming from there.
Good.
I would say the color palette is definitely pretty muted for a Wario Land game. I mean, especially, you know, I know the first couple were black and white originally, but maybe it's because the colorized versions of 2 and 3 were on Game Boy Color, which had a limited color palette, so they made them really sort of garishly bright colored. But I really do feel like Wario Land 4 has this sort of earthy kind of look to it overall, and it makes it a little less vibrant than I would like. And I felt that way about it when I originally played it mm-hmm. back on the, you know, unbacklit Game Boy Advance.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Like, did you have the same problem as everyone had with Castlevania? Or, like, was this game too dark?
No, it's not that dark.
Yeah.
It's not that dark. But it's a game that it's just not... I mean, and I put in Shake It last night because I wanted to, you know, sort of do a little bit of comparison with this game. On that end as well. And Shake It is definitely more colorful overall. I think pretty much all the Wario Land games that have color are more colorful than 4. And that does feel like it sets it apart. I mean, the other thing that really sets it apart, especially from 2 and 3, is that Wario has a life bar. And this was controversial at the time. I wasn't a big fan of that change. I'm still not really a huge fan of it. Yeah, so we had an interesting forum post about it from Oh Boy, who said that the life hearts let you experiment and sort of try different things without having to worry about whether you're going to die. And maybe that's true compared to other platformers where you sort of die in one or two hits, but that doesn't really make sense in the continuum of Wario Land games, because in 2 and 3 you could poke at everything all you ever wanted to and you could never die. You weren't even really penalized for trying things. Like, when you saw an enemy, the first thing you would do is run into it and see what happened. And Wario Land 4 is more like, it's pretty forgiving. I mean, you have to take a lot of hits to die. So that's not really ever a big concern, but at the same time, and several people noted this in the forums as well, but there is a sense that you don't really know which enemies transform you and which ones don't. And so you just sort of fling yourself at things and maybe it'll kill you and maybe it won't. And the same is true of like pits. Like, maybe you'll fall down into something and die and maybe you won't. I don't think there are any bottomless pits, but there are pits where you might go somewhere that you don't want to.
Yeah, and you can't climb back up, so you just missed out on whatever treasures were on the high road. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that did happen to me a couple of times.
Yeah, and the enemies, like, some of them are obvious. Like, obviously, a spear-carrying enemy, like, you don't want to rush into it. But
there's an enemy that throws spears at you. Or no, he shoots a bow and arrow at you.
Yeah.
And that does transform you. So I don't think there's any real logic. It's not obvious when you...
Like, the bees have this giant sting, and you would normally avoid them, but then if you get caught, it turns out it is a transformation that can be beneficial.
Yeah, and it's because they're trying to carry over what people expect in Wario Land games for these transformations, and they've decided to not make him invincible. And so I think it's just a broken paradigm. And I think that's one reason there isn't so much transformation in Shake It.
Well, in Shake It, you do sort of turn into these vehicles, but it's not activated by running into an enemy. It's just you sort of get a power up thing.
Yeah.
And you transform that way. So it's really obvious. Hey, cool. I found a transformation. Great. You know, but it's not like you're sort of testing the environment and trying to see what will transform you and what won't.
Yeah.
It's like those pistons in the factory level that come down and squish you. When you first look at that, right. I think you assume that you're going to take damage when you get hit by that. But in fact, they transform you into what can be a pretty useful form, which is the flat Wario that sort of lilts in the air when he jumps, and it lets you crawl through tight passageways that normally you couldn't.
How well do you guys think that it uses the transformations in this game? Because after playing 2 and 3, I felt like the transformations were marginalized in this game and kind of relegated to, you know, if you want to go for the high score versus in say 2 or 3, where you really had to use them to, you know, unlock the levels or progress.
I found myself, I got stuck in the first set of worlds, such that sets are, you know, it's a bit more open than that. And, like incredibly frustrated stuck. And it turns out the reason was it was one of those situations where we had the enemy didn't seem like it would be something that would give you a power. So I just left it alone. I killed it. And I couldn't figure out how to get past this vertical wall. So I went on, and having the ability to play the other stages, at least gave me something to do as opposed to feeling tremendously frustrated. It just so happened that when I played the next set of stages, I got stuck in another vertical wall with the same enemy and went, wait a minute.
I was surprised playing through it again this time that there are definitely places like James describes. It's not just with transformation. Sometimes it's that you have to break blocks in a certain way, or you have to jump down a hole that you might think would be deadly in order to get to the frog statue. But there are a number of places in these levels that are surprisingly abstract that you have to do to get through the level, or in order to get the key, for instance. And if you don't pick up the bird key thing that you have to find somewhere in the level, you can beat the whole level, but you won't be able to progress to the next one because you didn't find the key. So then you have to play all through it again. And then when you get to the boss door at the end of the map, if you haven't collected all the pieces of the stones, then you have to go back again. And some of those, a lot of them are pretty obvious, but some of them are pretty hard to find. And there were a couple where I went through the level 2 or 3 times and there was just this one piece that I could not get. I wasn't playing the level correctly. And it's frustrating because the levels are pretty big and they're pretty long. And also effectively, you have to play through them twice. You play through it forward and then you play through it backward with a time limit. And it's not like you can jump in there, get exactly what you need and then jump back out. You have to really play the entire level all over again. And when you're looking for one piece of something that's hidden in this kind of weird corner, that can be a little frustrating. You know, it's really not optional. You don't have to get it the first time through, but you do have to get it in order to progress.
And not only that, but your rush for time when you're on your way back, and certain pieces are only obtainable during that segment.
That's right. So the race through time is interesting to me. I mean, this was a big innovation when Wario Land 4 came out. They hadn't done that in the previous games. And it was definitely like, I remember sort of appreciating what they were trying to do with it. They're trying to give it this urgency, this sort of a race feel. They're trying to design levels that are played differently depending on which direction you're going, which is hard to do and is really admirable. But I felt like they didn't really execute on it. And to me, it never clicked. And that was a theme in the forum thread that was pretty common. A lot of people playing it and saying, I've played it for a few levels and it just really hasn't clicked. And for some people, it did later. For some people, maybe it never does. But the race back to the beginning of the level thing, I really did not like it. Oh, on the whole, I just found it to be kind of a mechanic that never really was very much fun to me until Shake It. And that's when they really figured out how to do it.
On about 2/3 of the level, I agree with you. But there are a handful of levels where it actually opens up a whole separate route back to the start of the level, and those are actually kind of enjoyable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with.
Yeah, but in Shake It, almost every level is that way.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I said the 2/3 of them I agree, and then there's about 1/3 where I'm like, yeah, these are fun. There's a level, I think it's in the third set of worlds, That when you hit the bomb frog statue, you basically drop off this big giant hole in the ground and drop all the way. You've basically gone up a long ways, and then you drop straight down for all the time you've gone up, and you actually go below what would be ground mm-hmm. level and find yourself in this underwater aqueduct that you have to swim
cool.
around in.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
up until that point, there's been no swimming whatsoever. You're like, whoa, what's this? And that's actually a really fun level. But in other ones, it's just like, yeah, just go backwards. And like, this isn't much fun. I don't.
Well,
much
the one where it transforms the level from lava into ice, that's really good.
Yeah.
That's a good level.
I think that the last set of levels, the fourth world, whatever you want to call it, has probably the most interesting level design, because that's the one that has the lava one. It also has the Arabian Night one, which I thought was kind of cool with the carpets and also how it uses the zombie stuff.
Yeah. That was my favorite world too, yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember what else is in that one, but there are definitely some. I think it was the hotel, the one with the hotel. That was kind
of probably the most maze like level of the game.
Yeah,
yeah. What's interesting to me is the game makes very little agency of explaining why he's going through all these incredibly bizarre places. Like if even in Shake It, which goes crazy pants insane. I mean it comes up with some incredibly contrived mechanism for displaying what the hell is going on. Whereas this game seems to not particularly care.
James,
which in a way
James,
I
you're
kinda
in a pyramid.
Like.
You're trying to get the treasure and you're warping, you know, Portrait of Ruin style, Mario 64 style into other places. What confusion is there? I mean, come on.
Yeah, well suddenly when I'm in a hotel, I'm like, "Wait,
actually,
what?"
Actually, like this is very very weird when you're coming from the first game directly to the fourth one. Because in the first game, the entire world is extremely coherent. Like you've got you start out on Rice Beach and it's a beach, and most of the levels are going to be pirate themed and beach themed. And then once you beat the boss, the beach is flooded and the stages have changed. Now they're flooded too. And so, like, you had really the sense of place. And here they just chuck that out the window. They're just like, well, we don't care. We want randomness.
Yeah, I'm really glad you touched on this, Guillaume, because I wanted to talk about the world design in this game, because I think it's really lazy compared with the other three that came there. Because, like you said, the first game was kind of Mario World style with, you know, a fully integrated world with, you know, branching paths and stuff. And then mm-hmm. Mario Land 2, it was kind of a narrative, and you went from place to place, and there was kind of a story, and, again, branching paths, and there was a sense of place and time. And the third one, it's, again, a world that, you know, there's like four sides of a globe or whatever it is, a snow globe or whatever. And again, there's
the levels are very tightly integrated in the
they
third
are.
Game.
Right. Yeah. You get a power up and then you go back and use that power up in this other level. And maybe it affects, you know, the layout of a level, kind of like you were talking about with the flooding in mm-hmm. Mario Land 1. And then they go from all that to Mario Land 4. I mean, the only thing I think of is that it must have been rushed to make it out for the Japanese launch. And they just felt like, well, we'll just throw this out the window. I mean, Mario 64 did it okay, so we'll just do that and, you know, save the effort. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of, because you're right. It's something that was integral to the Wario Land series, and it's just completely gone from this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it does give them the ability to have a lot of variety and to take you. I mean, there is a feeling that in some cases, even within this one kind of themed world, that each level
disparate.
Is quite different from each other. And that it's kind of fun, because it's like, well, you go in there, you know, it won't be like the one before. So I'm not opposed to that, but it's, for me, it's not so much the thematic unity that bothers me about it. It's more the actual design of the levels. And this was a popular topic in the forums. By the way, I'm paraphrasing everyone this time, so it's hopefully a little more natural. So if I take you out of context, I apologize. But the level design was a popular topic in the forum. So Lalmanade said, it feels like there's a correct path. I mean, these levels are non-linear and you're kind of exploring through. And it feels like there's a correct path, but there's really no indication of what that path is. And a lot of times you enter something and you're not really sure if this is the right way to go or if this is a bonus area. Did I just find a secret, or did I just find the way that you're supposed to go through the level? Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to tell most of the time. And I definitely got that same feeling. And XC Warrior actually said that the levels are really simple And a couple of people actually were saying that the game's a little too easy to get through, and it's too easy to find everything your first time through the level. I was pretty shocked to see those reactions to it, because I think the levels are labyrinthine, to say the least, and they're a lot of the things that you need to find, not just want to find, but need to find, are hidden in these kind of bizarre ways that you have to search for. And that's not a bad thing, but it gives the game a kind of an odd feel, where it's definitely not A to B.
It's not a bad thing, but I think the fact that to progress, you have to find all of these things that's is broken. Kind of annoying. Yeah, like, if they said, okay, you need X number of these round of the semicircle or of the quarter circles, fine. You know, we could deal with that. Let me find, you know, say 6 out of 8 and let me go through. But to make you find all 16 for a set is kind of annoying.
So a couple people compared it to Sonic the Hedgehog, and I thought this was really surprising, but I guess they're referring to the, you know, after you jump on the frog statue and you have a time limit now and you have to race back to the beginning of the stage.
I would think not just because of the speed and the fact that you're running, but I mean, the level design, yeah, I can kind of see the comparison, because Sonic levels usually have several paths, through a single level. And you have to find the optimal line. Here, there's no optimal anything, but the levels do feel like there's a lot of, you know, like if you can get just like a little bit higher, you're going to find a different path. And
Well, Synaptic described it as when you play through these levels in Mario Land 4, it feels like you're either missing a lot, whatever path you pick, it kind of feels like it's the wrong one and you're missing things on either side. Or if you try to find them all, it feels like you're spending too much time and you're sort of playing the game too slowly.
I could see that. Yeah. It feels like you're just kind of either just plowing through or you're just kind of getting plotted. You're plodding along. There's no real sense of just a nice pace. I mean, sometimes you just happen across all the things because they're right there. And sometimes, you know, there's one, like the key. You can't find where the key's flying around. Or there's one piece you're missing. And you don't want to just sit there and look for it, because that's really not all that interesting. But in the end, you have to. So you just,
yeah, you know, okay, I'll play the game again, but I'll get it now. Because, I haven't had too much trouble finding things, but part of it's probably because I played this game a lot way back when, and so at some level I remember some of this. And the other thing is, to some extent, Wario Land games have always been a little bit about poking around and finding all the nooks and crannies. Maybe this game does it in a way that maybe forces it a little more than it should, but I mean, that to me, that's just part of Wario.
Well, like I think that there's a greater number of levels that are just a little bit too sprawling. A little bit, you know, you kind of feel like, yeah, without guidance. And those are definitely the ones that are that leave me, that are the least enjoyable to me. I would say that the levels where you have, like, it's very, very clear what you have to do to get through, those were the most enjoyable. For instance, the domino level, where you're racing against, you know, dominoes hitting each other.
I really like that one. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a race, you know, to get to the goal before the stack of dominoes just falls.
Yeah. So that's a level in which you're actually trying to race forward through the level, not just backwards back out of it.
Yeah.
And so the whole level just kind of goes by really fast because you're really trying to rush through it, but you're supposed to. You know, and I like the pace of that level quite a bit.
Yeah, and in that level, the challenge is not finding where to go, because it's always very, very clear. It's just to go fast enough to be able to collect the treasure along the way. So in a way, like, it's really one of the most linear levels. And I think that's really where the game shines. And
there's a trail of dominoes showing you the way forward.
Yeah. And another level that was really straightforward is the ice one, 40 Below Fridge, I think it's called. And that level, I don't know if you guys had the same impression, but there's a lot of puzzles where you have to let snow fall on you, and so you become this big ball of snow, and then you have to find an incline to roll off of. And then it's just like you start rolling through the level without being able to stop. And you have to find the correct way to get through the different ramps. And that really, really gave me feelings of Metroid Fusion. the Shine Spark segments.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
like,
funny.
It's exactly the same type of puzzle. You had to find the right inclines. You have to speed through this whole maze. But yeah, like you've got this the challenge of being able of going fast and hitting all the ramps all just right so you can make it to the exit. And mm-hmm. I actually checked on Moby Games and yeah, they've got the two level designers who worked on Metroid Fusion also worked on Wario Land.
Well, this isn't the first time we've brought up the fact that there is a bit of cross-pollination between the Wario Land teams and Metroid. I mean,
yeah, but there, yeah. Like, I really felt it. You know, when did I start playing Metroid here?
Well observed. If when you play Wario Land 3, you will really notice it because it's much more pronounced in that game.
Yeah.
So to get to a couple other forum comments, I thought this one was really interesting from Pandera Docs. He said that he referred to Donkey Kong 94, which is also on the eShop, of course. Well, it is on this game is not on the eShop yet. They'll sell it eventually, but yeah. So DK94, it's a very good game, but he mentions how every world where they introduce new mechanics, they show this little cutscene in the intro that gives you an example of how it's done and what might happen when you use certain things or when certain enemies show up, and it gives you certain expectations. It's not like it spoils the mechanics of the whole world, but it gives you an idea of something to try that might help you solve these puzzles. And Wario Land 4 doesn't do that at all. And in fact, he says that basically the game gives you no general expectations whatsoever of how to play it. And I think that's a really interesting observation. I found the same thing. It's like I started playing the game and it's very rich in mechanics. You've got all these transformations. Wario has a lot of moves. The tutorial level is like gives you almost – it's funny because it takes you through and it shows you what all the controls do. But yeah. It gives you almost no idea of how to solve the puzzles in the game because the puzzles are go way beyond what they show in the tutorial. And even in the first world, I went to the jungle level first, which I think is a mistake. It's probably most people do because it's on the lower right. So it's very close to where you start on the map. But I think it's actually one of the hardest worlds and also one of the most confusing in terms of how to find things and how to get through it.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. I found so, yeah. I got stuck a couple of times in the jungle world, and I went to the other ones and found that I got through those much easier. But the game has you doing all kinds of really strange stuff, and I feel like it doesn't really prepare you for that. And we've talked about sort of poking at things to try to see what works. But I feel like that's not just to find the secret stuff. It's really just to solve even the standard required puzzles in the game.
Well, I think maybe the designers assumed incorrectly that players were familiar with perhaps 2 and 3, 2 and or 3, which introduced a lot of these transformations that you see in Wario Land 4. And so I have to wonder if that was kind of a blind spot in the, the level designers' purview.
I think that's very possible. It's funny though, because I went the other way when I started out. Like I started with a fire world that turns to ice. So I went clockwise instead of counterclockwise. And right. So the jungle world was one of the, like, it was the last that I played through. And I thought like, whoops, I think I played the toughest levels, first. And this is the actual introduction. This is where I was supposed to start.
Maybe it's just that you learned how to play the game, and so whatever level you play last will feel like the easiest.
Maybe, but
I don't think so.
That first jungle level is kind of a straight line, and a lot of the treasures are right in your way.
Yeah, the lava level is. I mean, I actually died on that one because I was trying to get everything on my quote unquote first run through, and there's just a lot of ways to die if you're just trying to poke around. I mean, that's not an easy level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now we've been complaining about how the game doesn't show you how to play, but I think EJamer on the board said that all the transformations are detailed in the manual. Now, of course, I think most of us are. Yeah.
Oh, actually, if you bring it up, that manual is hilarious. I actually mentioned it in my review. Apparently, like, there's like a maze you can, like, if you're bored, you can draw a little maze, you know, one of those old mazes with a pen, and like their jokes. And I don't know, it's like all written in by Wario. I mean, it's,
oh, really?
It's insane. if this ever comes out on eShop, check it out.
On the 3DS version, you can pull it up with the home screen?
No, because it's an ambassador game.
So what's funny, though, is that Wario was always kind of just, like, a bad dude. Like, in the first, like, when he's introduced, he's just, he's not
Yeah, he's
weird,
bad and greedy. He's
bad.
Greedy. I mean,
yeah,
that's,
yeah,
that
but
was
he's,
his thing.
But as the series has gone on, I think in this game especially, we really get to see the quirks of what is Wario. I mean, he's weird dude. I mean, it's just besides being bad and greedy, he's just odd. He has a lot of quirks that make him give him this weird personality that's sort of unique in the Mario world. I mean, unless you want to count Waluigi, which I don't, because he's the exclusive purview of sports and party games.
And it's what led to them doing WarioWare a couple years later, where they that game has nothing to do with Wario and everything to do with the character and personality of Wario.
I think Nintendo increasingly fell in love with the character they were creating because he is so different from everything else they have.
So is this the part where we start talking about the minigames?
Oh, God. Because there was I totally forgot about those things.
There's definitely some WarioWare in this game.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to me, I brought it up because I didn't know about the manual, but like it feels like Wario, things made for Wario, in this game especially, increasingly became Nintendo's love letter to a character they created. I think they just, you know, they've been making relatively benign heroes for 20-some years at this point. I think for them to get to create something that's just, for a character that's not only bad, but also kind of an idiot. I mean, Wario is kind of a moron in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And he's... But he has this great personality of, you know, I'm the best. He's got much more character than Bowser. And in fact, you can see after Wario went to this weird place, they started inflecting Bowser the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Nintendo sort of fell in love with making Wario, and things like that manual is a great example. How much time do you think it took the localization team to go ahead and flip what was, I'm sure, a completely insane manual in Japan into a completely insane U.S. and European manual? I mean, I feel like this is sort of a departure point for Nintendo, where they decided, you know what, our characters do matter. And having these, we can't do much with our heroes. We kind of have to leave them flat. But we can go crazy with our villains. And we can do whatever the hell we want. And you see this in, like, Paper Mario on 64. Like, this characters start to get real strange. And you see this a lot in Thousand Year Door. They get real strange.
Well, and then there's Fawful on the GBA games. And there's, you know, Waluigi shows up around this time.
It's almost
always
the villains that get weird.
Well, that's true in a lot of medium. That like, you know, the villains, that you know, the secret star of the show, because the foibles are. I don't remember who someone said this. For a villain, the foibles are there for everyone to see. For the hero has to be, you know, whatever, steadfast and strong. You know, that's why Mickey Mouse is a boring character, and Donald Duck is maybe more interesting. It's the same kind of thing. You know, Donald Duck. You know, at least for a while, he had a lot of temper, you know?
It's why Luigi's more interesting than Mario as a character.
Yeah, I guess
so. He has more personality.
I guess, but I mean, they all pale in comparison to what they've done to their villains. I mean, even if you look at what they've done to Ganondorf since say, Wind Waker, he's sort of gone off the deep end. I mean, he's become this sort... They sort of went retrograde on Twilight Princess. But, like, he's kind of a weird dude in Wind Waker, and he's kind of weird. He's kind of weird in Twilight Princess. I mean, he's not just, like, big beast purple man who also is a pig.
Isn't this just a function of injecting more story in their games, though?
To an extent, but yeah. I think it's also injecting more character into their characters, which isn't necessarily the same as more story.
So, To get back to Wario Land a little bit, Leah's dad posted something sort of late in the thread, and I'm glad he was able to catch up with it. He said he really liked, and like I said, a lot of people like the frog race, the sort of racing back to the beginning, even though I think it's a little half-baked in this game. It definitely is fresh in its own way. But you describe that as a leap of faith, because you're going through the level and you see all this stuff that you don't understand. You see these places that are blocked off by the frog blocks that you can't get to. You see things that you would like to get, but you're not really sure how. And at some point you sort of leave, you sort of trust in the game designers that they will provide a way for you to get to it. So you just keep on pushing through until you hit the statue. And then on the way back, you're rushed and you don't really have time to stop and inspect and figure out how the level's put together. You just have to keep going forward. And again, you sort of trust the level designer to give you a path back to the beginning.
Yeah, and it never happened that I was rushing back and didn't find the exit. They really funnel you toward it.
Yeah, so right. In fact, that they basically wall off everything else. I mean, you can really only go to the exit. The only real danger you have is that you get stopped by things beyond your control, like enemies.
Well, or you go to the exit before you collect the MacGuffin.
But yeah, that just means you're going to make a return trip.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And on that note, actually, a number of people, including Rebinac, who was the last person who posted in the thread before we recorded, described having an experience where the first couple of times they tried to play this game, it didn't work for them. They went off and either came back and eventually it just sort of clicked, or in Rebinac's case, went off and played other Wario Land games and then came back and understanding how the game is put together and understanding the character and the way that the designers use the character, made the game more accessible after having that experience. And I think as a first game, it's interesting that Nintendo gave this away to a lot of people in the Ambassador program, because I think as your first Wario Land game, it's a pretty tough pill to swallow. Yeah. And that's why we saw a lot of people in the thread. It was divisive. You know, a lot of people were sort of getting frustrated by it, or they felt like, you know, they tried several levels and it just really wasn't working for them. And I think having the familiarity and understanding the mechanics as you go in does make a huge difference, because the game really doesn't explain itself to you very well. Mm-hmm. So I think if you've tried playing the game before and didn't like it or didn't understand it, if you've played something like Shake It, for instance, or if you've gone back and played Wario Land 1 or 2 on Game Boy or Virtual Console or whatever, I think it is very much worth trying to come back to Wario Land 4 and give it another shot, because it does sort of stand on its own even within the franchise, but there's enough overlap and similarity from other things that it helps a lot if you understand this world and the way the character works.
What's funny in Rebinac's case, though, is that he played the first game and the Virtual Boy game. And both those games are different in that Wario, his power-ups are different hats. He can turn small, he can take damage, you know. And the level design really isn't the same. Like, there's no transformations at all. You know, I'm not sure how much you can learn about the way that Wario Land 4 is put together by playing those first two games.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can speak from experience on the Virtual Boy game, and you can't. There's not much to glean from the experience of playing the Virtual Boy game in this regard. Mm-hmm. It feels like a very different game.
But maybe if you go into Wario Land 4 expecting it to play like a Mario game, for instance,
it won't.
Then it could be a real turnoff. And I think if you just go back and play the original Wario Land or even the Virtual Boy game, I do think it will sort of inoculate you to playing the game at a different pace and having less of a focus on challenging platform action and more of a focus on looking for secret places and sort of testing out the level design. Mm-hmm. So maybe in that sense it would help. I mean, it did for him. So
yeah, you know, sounds reasonable.
I just thought it was a really interesting observation. So ultimately, in conclusion, I'd like to kind of go around and get your sort of final thoughts on the game, and you know, would you recommend it? Are you glad you played more of it? Is it one of your favorite Wario Land games? So let's start with Guillaume.
Well, I can tell you right now, it is not one of my favorite Wario Land games. It's really strange coming from the first game to this, because I feel like the philosophy is, the game design philosophy is completely different. The first game is actually really, really hard, and you'll find tons of pits to fall into lose lives. You'll take damage, get killed by enemies all the time. Like I've played that game so many times, and when I revisited it when it was in the eShop, I still died many, many times. So like it's not an easy game, and here you're almost invincible, except not really, and you won't fall into pits. It's just really this maze and go explore and solve puzzles. And there were very few puzzles to speak of in Wario Land, the first one. This is not the way that I envisioned the series to evolve. And, you know, I never expected it to turn into this. But nevertheless, it's very good at what it does. But also I've played this after playing Shake It, which takes many of the ideas that this game introduced and made them so much better. That it's just like playing Wario Land 4 is more of a curiosity, you know, like, oh, okay, so this is the origin, like this is where all this comes from. Yeah, it was interesting to play through, but ultimately there are much, much better games in the series.
Cool. James, what are your sort of closing thoughts on Wario Land 4?
I got kind of annoyed with how the game didn't necessarily tell you how to solve, I didn't give you much hints in the way of solving some of these puzzles. You know, when I'd solve them, I'd be like, ha, there you go, I get it. But for me, you know, it feels a little old. I mean, it is old, but it feels a little creaky in the joints, as it were. And, I'll probably go through and poke at it some more sometimes, but really more as a function of when I don't have anything else to play, not so much as actively seeking out time to play it. I actually enjoyed the Virtual Boy game more than this one, and not just because it gave me headaches.
Yeah, the Wario Land for Virtual Boy is awesome. If you ever get a chance to play it, you should.
Yep. And by getting a chance to play it, Johnny means, will you ever get a chance to buy a used Virtual Boy on eBay and then purchase a copy of its most expensive, readily available game? Versus the games that are not readily available and cost hundreds of dollars.
Right, right.
Well, the so Virtual Boy version... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Just quickly, the Virtual Boy version is a direct sequel to the first one. Same moves, same power-ups. It's just very, very short. It's in 3D, and it's very, very short. 12 levels or so.
And it looks awesome.
It is very short, yes.
But it's worth playing.
Yeah. So 2IP, what about you? You're sort of our expert witness here a little bit. I imagine that your feelings are similar to mine in that you actually played the original games in the order that they came out. And
yeah.
So to me, this is a step backwards. I mean, you guys talk about how it's like, you know, sort of very weird and like, you know, it's because it's more exploration based. It feels so far astray from the original Wario Land. But actually, if you play 2 and 3, they're almost pure exploration.
Yeah.
And to me, the design of 4 feels kind of loose compared to the really tightly, ingeniously designed puzzle box that is Wario Land 3 in particular.
What Johnny said, definitely Wario Land 4 is not my favorite game in the series. I enjoyed revisiting it, but it did revalidate my, you know, what I remembered, that this game just doesn't feel like what I think of as a Wario Land game. And I guess I don't think of the first Wario Land game as a Wario Land game, although I really like it. Really, to me, Wario Land 2 and Wario Land 3 is what Wario should be. Wario Land Shake It is very fun, and it's a little closer to that. But, I mean, 3 is just sort of the pinnacle of the series. And you're right, just sort of the exploration where just confined areas where you're just sort of poking around and trying to find, you know, really cool little areas. That's Wario Land to me. And 4 just doesn't have a whole lot. It has more of it than I remembered, but it's still just, it can't hold a candle to 2 or 3.
Yeah. But it's still a very good game. It is. Very good game. It's really cool. And of course, if you're a 3DS ambassador, you've got no reason to not give it a shot. And one of the great things about there being these 4 worlds that you can visit in any order is that if you start on one and you don't like it, you can very easily just go try a completely different section of the game. So you're not likely to get really hard stuck on the game. So you can at least sort of sample it and maybe you'll find kind of a weak point and get into it and sort of maybe let it grow on you like it did a lot of people who played along with us.
Yeah, I mean, so, there is a certain inflection of difficulty, though. Like some sets are more difficult than others.
Yeah, I would say the difficulty of the game is very uneven overall, actually. Some levels are just playing way harder than the one right before or the one right after.
Which is the best.
Yeah. But it is sort of it's a little messy in that way, a little sloppy, but still really interesting and has a lot of cool ideas. So I hope you'll check it out sometime. Thanks everybody who played along with us and left very insightful comments. I skipped over most of the arguing, but there's actually a pretty intense debate in the Retroactive Forum thread that you might want to check out sometime. And if you waited to play the game, or if you didn't quite have it yet and you get a copy I hope you'll enjoy it. Let us know what you think, and feel free to post in the forum thread. It'll stick around. So it'll always be there for you to check it out for yourself and maybe even contribute. That's going to do it for Retroactive and for this episode. Next week, we will probably get back into listener mail, so I would love to hear what you think on anything going on in the world of video games. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Hopefully, John will be back. We certainly miss him. And TYP, thank you so much, dude, for coming and being a pinch hitter for us. I really appreciate it, man.
Always a pleasure.
He did an awesome job. Really couldn't have asked for a much better person to do this particular Retroactive. One last plug before we go. I did want to mention that there is a new episode of Radio Trivia with TYP and Guillaume.
Hey.
Gasp. Are you surprised, Guillaume? Did you not know you recorded an episode? Is this like when you bought your 3DS XL?
Yeah, totally blacked out. Bottle of scotch in my hands.
And suddenly you're like, why do I want to play game? I can't say any of the names of the game that are in it yet, because it's only the first week.
Yeah, I don't want to give away. I don't want to spoil anything out, because it's only been up for like a day as of recording.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil any of the games, but I do want to say that listen to the episode. I can guarantee you will hear the moon song from DuckTales. So that alone is worth listening to any podcast.
Thank you so much, TYP, for including that.
You're welcome.
I begged him.
Thank you for begging him to include it, because I'm right there with you, Guillaume. I love that song. So that if that's not incentive to listen, I don't know what is. You can listen to DuckTales'
Money.
Moon Song.
It's Money the best. Is an incentive.
It's the freaking best ever. So yes, please check that out. It's Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. Look for it on iTunes or NintendoWorldReport.com, where you'll see us every day as well. Thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Peace. Bye.
Bye. AML Rotten Day.
And the fact that they kind of rushed it, which I understand. I mean, like, they did rush the game, and it is a disappointment that there's not really any original music, or that the bosses are really an afterthought, which they have been in many Mario games, to be fair.
Well, maybe, but
Mario has never had good bosses ever.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree.
Putting that out, Mario Brothers, every boss is the same shit.
No, there are some...
Sometimes he shoots fire, sometimes there's a bridge over his head. The bosses are not good ever in Mario. They're
I
not.
Disagree. I think the bosses in Galaxy 2 were actually, at least half of them, were actually really fun.
You mean the half that weren't the same as the bosses from
Galaxy
1?
Well, I did just
1?
Say, well, or half of them.
Yeah, I'm all surprised right, you would right. bring up a Galaxy game, because EAD Tokyo is especially bad about bosses and repeating bosses.
Well, no, like I
games.
Said, half of them. Half of them are actually really enjoyable experiences.
James,
but
that's
yeah, back to the new Super Mario Brothers 2.
There are
though.
Exceptions.
Well, if there's an exception to the rule, you can't say never. Or emphasize never four
no,
or five
I'm
times.
I'm saying never in the history of Mario has a game in that series had consistently good bosses throughout the game.
I would say it was
I'm
consistently
saying,
every
yes,
other boss.
Occasionally there have been games that had like one good boss.
I would say that game had like five good bosses.
I think the Bowser in Mario 3 is awesome.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he's like the one good boss in that game.
Wow, why did I start? Anyway, despite...
Now playing. That's an interesting observation. I can't argue with it.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Whoa! Did somebody start a bandsaw?
Sounds like a refrigerator.
It does, doesn't it?
It does.
Because it is, isn't it?
Don't worry.
I thought Bob Vila had started up in the background. What's going on?
I told you it's pretty damn loud.
I only heard it for a second, but it was like, whoa, who's cutting cabinetry?
James, why don't you tell us what you've been playing
acquiring? Yeah. Okay, sorry. Yeah, acquiring is probably
the
right
word. Can you talk over the song?
What?
No, sorry. I was trying to get in a position that's more comfortable to talk in.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I can't hear you. Now playing. He did an awesome job. Really couldn't have asked for a much better person to do this particular retro.
Well, maybe Wario himself.
Oh.
Hey, you shut up, you piece of crepe.
Did you just call him a crepe? What?
A piece of crepe, to be
a
fair.
A piece of crap.
A piece of crepe.
All right, just a little bit of crepe, please.